The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
In this post-Roe world, as women's reproductive rights disappear in real time, demand for vasectomies is skyrocketing.
Half will get vasectomies done in this sperm-clad clinic on wheels, the rest in a Planned Parenthood feet away. Doctors say demand is skyrocketing, and for most, it's no secret why.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a bizarre story, but really a byproduct of where we are right now. I saw a disturbing story, and I don't know whether if you have kids, you should start the radio down for a minute or two. It came from LifeSite News, and they were saying now that men can't rely on abortions anymore to shirk their parental responsibilities, many are requesting permanent sterilizations or vasectomies instead. And the abortion chain Planned Parenthood, well, they're stepping up, right? They are more than glad to meet their requests because that's how they make their money. It's all about abortion. Right? It's all about contraception. America's biggest abortion business is doing more and more vasectomies, and they're doing it for free. And I don't understand why they're doing it for free. Because if this is all about money, what's behind it? Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris will join me in a minute. We'll talk to her about it. They are doing free vasectomies for any man who wants it in a trailer called the Nutcracker. And I am not kidding. That's what they're calling this mobile sterilization unit that they have. I mean, it's really very, very bizarre. There's one other aspect here, too. And just as a side note to this, there was another story that I came across where journalists think that today's kids need, in addition to pens and paper and stuff for school, they need fentanyl strips. You know, that the opioid antidote drug is a thing called naloxone or Narcan, along with these COVID tests and vaccines. And they suggest that your kids have contact information for mental health experts on their phone. And they're even suggesting that your daughters make sure that they have contraception available. So, when I grew up, we had none of this. I don't know about you, right? I mean, you talk about an attack on the latency, you take an attack on the innocence of our children. You know, fentanyl strips, contraception, all this stuff. Oh, you got to be safe, right? Whether it's drugs, whether it's sex. This is an attack, and I've said it before, just from a spiritual perspective, on the family and on children. It is bizarre. It is really bizarre. Here to talk a little bit about all of this is Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris. She's the founder and president of the Ruth Institute. It's a global nonprofit organization that's dedicated to doing some great work. They want to create a lasting Christ-like mass social movement, if you will, to end this injustice of the attack on the family, the breakdown of the family. And she addresses everything, contraception, to so much of the stuff that we're seeing, like these mobile units to provide vasectomies and more. You can check her out at ruthinstitute.org. That's ruthinstitute.org. Dr. Morris, great to have you back. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. We certainly have some odd things to talk about here, don't we?
It's a strange story. I don't even know which one to start with. Let's start with the Nutcracker, if you will. You know, it's a Planned Parenthood wants to provide vasectomy vans. Maybe abortion is down. I don't know. What's the rationale behind this? Because they're not even monetizing it, from what I understand.
Well, you know, first of all, I hope little children aren't listening to this. People, if you have kids in the car, turn it off and come back and get the podcast later.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, calling your thing the Nutcracker, that doesn't seem like very good advertising to me. I mean, I suppose it's funny, but no, it's not really funny. Right. You know, I mean, they're basically saying we're going to assault your manhood and you're supposed to laugh at it while we're doing it. Yeah, isn't that what it means to crack?
Maggie, you were saying something very similar, weren't you?
I was. We were talking about this yesterday. I was like, isn't that usually the butt of a joke about mm-hmm. a man that, you know, anyway.
Right.
I pulled I pulled the audio for that open at the beginning of this segment, and I'm literally looking at the screen where I pulled the audio from this NBC News segment. Mm-hmm. They have an image of this trailer, and it says, I kid you not, on the side it says, "One small snip for man,
oh my gosh.
One giant leap for humankindness."
Wow.
This is what they always do. They couch violence in what they say is compassion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what this reminds me of? When my daughter went to Berkeley, she had a public health professor who was an unapologetic eugenics population control guy. I mean, not choice, but population control. And he used to brag about how many vasectomies he himself had performed.
Wow.
In India. And, you know, they were setting up camps to vasectomize people. And, you know, they pay guys a little bit of money in order to, you know, because they thought they had too many people, yada, yada, yada. They tried to incentivize guys snipping the family jewels. And you know, when people are desperately poor and you're giving them money or you're giving them food, you know, that's not exactly a fair transaction. Okay, so that's what was going on over there. And what we're seeing here is kind of the normalization of sex as an intrinsically sterile activity. I mean, this has been the point of the sexual revolution for a long time, is to be able to say to people, you can have all the sex you want, you'll never have a live baby. You are allowed to think of sex as a purely recreational activity with no social significance. And these people are so desperate to keep that alive, and, you know, keep that dream alive, that vasectomy is the solution in case you can't get an abortion whenever you want one. Well, wait a minute, hold on here a minute, you know. It's pretty much admitting that abortion is not so much a woman's issue as they were wanting us to believe. It's also a man's issue because men want to have access to women's bodies without the responsibilities of fatherhood. And this very clearly shows the appeal of this whole program for men.
Well, let's talk about what a vasectomy does to a relationship as well. And I had a guest on at some point in time who talked about how the dynamic of one's relationship ends. I mean, you think, oh, this is going to be great. Now I don't need contraception, right? And of course, from a Catholic perspective, I mean, this is immoral. I mean, you should not be doing this. It's a procedure that involves cutting or blocking the tubes that carry your sperm from the testicle to, you know, to the urethra. And what they do is considered safe, but and it can be reversed in some cases, but, you know, it's a permanent form of contraception, you know, but there are emotional and psychological and even relational implications from this. What have you found? What are the challenges that come? Does intimacy change? Does identity or relationship, does the emotional relationship change between partners? Some argue it gets better, but I've heard there's a lot of research out there saying that that's not always the case.
Well, I have to admit, this is not a particular area that I've studied particularly closely. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to cite this as if I know all the research, because I really don't. But what one hears anecdotally is that now that sex is sterile for the man, sex is, you know, for him, it's sterile. This makes it easier for him to have secondary sex partners. And if you're an unmarried man, it makes it easier for you to just do whatever you want, right? But even if you're married and you and your wife agree to it, it makes it easier for you to have something on the side. And I don't know how anybody can deny that that's the case, right? How often do people take advantage of that? I personally don't have any way of knowing that. I don't know that that's been studied, but probably someone has. I don't know. I don't want to go let my mind run down that path because I don't know the answer to that. But, you know, I mean, I think any even a small amount of reflection will tell you that this has to be the consequence, you know, that you want for your body to be sterile so that you never have to deal with it. That's what is really at stake here.
So Planned Parenthood with these vasectomy units, it's really bizarre. We also have, what, abortion units, too, that cruise around, too. I think there are some facilities like that where they have this. But what happens after the man gets neutered and ultimately the the focus for this is what? We just want to advance a culture of sterility? Are we worried about overpopulation? What do you think is driving that?
Well, certainly, there's no question, Drew, that some people are certainly worried about overpopulation. And, you know, the population control people have been behind large parts of the sexual revolution from the very beginning. And the most significant aspect of it is that they have pumped in the money that has supported all of this type of stuff. So, you know, you go back to the beginning, it's John D. Rockefeller III who really pioneered the idea that there are too many people in the world and who founded the Population Council and who tried to, you know, convince people that there are too many people and we have to do something about it. And he, you know, most people were pretty creeped out by that when he was talking about that in the 60s and stuff. But when he came up with the idea, it really was, you know, I don't know who convinced him, but it's some literally in 1974 at an important speech in Bucharest at the Population Council meeting that he sponsored and let himself have the keynote speech, of course. He basically stopped talking about too many people in population control and started talking about women's empowerment. And what we really need to do is have women get higher education, women have jobs, women in the workforce, because he saw if you did that, that would by itself, the women themselves would want fewer children. And so he could achieve many of his objectives without looking like he was being heavy-handed, bossing people around, you know, and controlling people, right? Yeah. So he shifted tactics. That's how it's been ever since. I mean, that has been a very successful strategy. And that's what we're dealing with now. In order to call yourself a feminist, you have to be in favor of abortion and contraception, 100% without question. Wow. Prior to this thing that I'm talking to you about, Drew, there were plenty of women who looked at contraception and said, this is bad for women's bodies. This is bad for women's relationships. What do you mean we want to have abortion? Are you kidding me? Those are our babies. What we want is more support from our husbands. And, you know, we want more respect in the workplace. We want more respect in the judiciary. And, you know, we don't want to be treated like little women. We want to be treated like adults. And, you know, they had a whole bunch of different objectives. And looking at the population control idea, yeah, it was like, that was gross. You know, that was, we don't want this, you know. Minority groups, but there, you know, there was a meeting that included blacks and Hispanics, and they looked at this, and this is the late 60s. They looked at this going, what are you kidding me? Promoting contraception? This is genocide. You're trying to make sure there aren't too many colored people running around. Right. You know, that's where they viewed it. And of course, that wasn't wrong, right? But that's all gone underground so that now the politically correct thing that you have to believe in order to be a feminist in good standing or even a decent human being in any kind of good standing is there are too many people and we need birth control and abortion and all the rest of it so that women can be happy, so that we can have, but that's a fiction. That's the story we tell ourselves. Yeah. The reality is men want this too. You know, men want sex without babies as much as some women do. So, this thing you're seeing, this mobile vasectomy van, it's like a symbol of this whole way of thinking. You know, it's like in a nutshell. Wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't have said nutshell. But anyway, in a nutshell, you know, it's kind of illustrating the whole problem.
Yeah, I think of Humana Vitae and Paul VI and what he wrote regarding how, this is where, you know, contraception will ultimately lead, right? I mean, the women will be objectified. They'll be used. And to the point that you just made, we are living in a time where there is a contraceptive mindset or mentality. I even heard Nikki Haley during the Republican debates, you know, they were talking about abortion, but she brought up the issue of contraception. Everybody takes it as something that everybody should have and embrace, and yet there are a lot of byproducts of this, and we can talk about that. The connection between birth control use and mental health issues, especially with young girls, young women, it's complex. It's evolving. I know you know a lot about that. Let me open the phones, and we can talk about this as well. Love to hear from you. I only have about 10 minutes left with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris. If you want to join us, the number's 888-914-9149. You can call now and get in, so you can call right now and get in at 888-914-9149. Gentlemen, if you've had vasectomies and had it reversed or you regret it, love to hear why. And I'd also like to hear how contraception, how vasectomies, tubal ligations, the use of it, has affected your relationship. Has it changed things? We often talk about taking the pill and what it does to one's perception of the other sex and their other partner, how that gets changed. And there's been studies done with apes and a whole litany of things that we can get into. But right now, feminists are decrying the culture all the time, you know, and how would this, you know, improve what they've already see as sexually violent culture towards women? I think it only foments that, doesn't it, doctor?
Right. That's the thing. You know, if you're worried about women being abused by men, why would you create a whole ethos which says that sex is an entitlement? You know, I mean, who really thinks that sex is an entitlement? A rapist thinks that sex is an entitlement. Oh, wow. Why are we even cultivating such an attitude? You know what I mean? Think about it. And that we've all gone down this path of thinking, well, as long as it's consensual, I can use you and you can use me. As long as we agree with it, it's okay. Yeah. And nobody perceives themselves being on kind of the receiving end of the whole thing. They perceive themselves being on the fun, you know, that I'm going to get to have fun. Yeah. But they don't think about what it's going to feel like when you get dumped, what it's going to feel like when your boyfriend is having sex with someone other than you because he can, because he's had a vasectomy. And how cruddy you're going to feel when you find out he's messing around on the side. You know, we never think about that aspect. We all think we're going to be winners, but we never think about being on the, you know, being the victim of the thing. That's the problem. And it's amazing. Yeah. Actually, it's an amazing con job that has been worked on all of us.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a perfect way of putting it. It's been a con job. And you take a look at where we are. People think it's liberating and freeing, but really it's damaging and enslaving. What impact has this had, in your opinion? I know you study a lot of this. You've got sociologists that work with you as well. We see marriage numbers decreasing. Right. So a lot of people are no longer marrying. Maybe it's because they can have sex without consequence there. Is it contributing to the lack of marriage, or is it contributing simply to the lack of children or the openness to it? I mean, how do you see this contraceptive mentality, you know, playing out even in marriages? Are we seeing more divorce because this has been invited into the relationship?
Oh, holy cow, man. You've got like 14 different questions. Throwing me. How long do I have?
60 seconds, doctor. No, I'm kidding you. I'm kidding you. Take as much time as you need.
Well, okay. So, I mean, the first thing that you said that, I'm losing the different threads of it. There's a consequence inside of marriage, and then there's a consequence for whether you get married in the first place. Yeah. All right. And over the course of our lifetime, we have seen a substantial decline in marriage and the substituting for cohabitation instead of marriage. Okay, so that was kind of the first move that we all saw. But now people are afraid even to be in relationship. This is the thing that I'm noticing now, that young people don't really expect to find lasting love. This is, to me, the most tragic and saddest thing. They don't really expect it. They've seen so much brokenness around them. They've seen so much exploitive type of sexual interactions. You know, they've seen so much of that, not just in the media, but in their, you know, they've had personal encounters with it in some way, whether they see their parents doing crazy stuff or, you know, one of their parents being harmed by the other parent or the, you know, secondary sex partners and the whole nine yards. Yeah. You know, and so there's a lot of fear, I think. That's my sense, Drew, is that a lot of young people are afraid. They want commitment. They want reliable love, but they're really afraid of being hurt. Yeah. And they don't realize that cohabiting and just having casual sex, that is never going to really make them happy. That's not going to give them what they're really looking for. It'll give them maybe some kind of satisfaction or facsimile of what they're looking for, but it won't be the whole thing that they're looking for, you know? So that, to me, that's one of the saddest things out there, is the fear that people have of even entering into relationships.
That's so well said. Zooming out from the relationship to the amount of money that goes into this, I saw a piece where the Wizard of Omaha, right? We're talking about Warren Buffett. He's one of America's most revered investors. There's been a recent revelation to the dark side of what all that money is that he has, and billions of dollars are going for abortion on demand. There are experiments on poor Africans. There's a groundbreaking report. I think I saw this in Restoration News. They talked about this massive money pipeline, including Bill and Melinda Gates, their foundation, and Buffett's global depopulation agenda. There's a lot of money going to fund not just abortion, but contraception. I mean, this is part, and then I think Warren's the sixth wealthiest man in the world. What do you make of such big money behind all this? I mean, Planned Parenthood is peanuts compared to some of these guys.
Well, I think this is a really important point for pro-life people to understand, and for Roman Catholic people in particular to understand, that there are a handful of billionaires who have pumped literally billions of dollars into making people think that there are too many people in the world.
Yep.
And if you really stop and think about that, who in the world is really in charge of the question of how many people there are in the world? I mean, by what right do you say there are too many people in the world? By what standard? By what metric? And then by what right do you go around and say, I'm going to do something about this, you know? I mean, it's astonishing, really, when you think at how people accept this rhetoric and don't really question what exactly does this mean?
Yep.
There are too many people in the world, you know? I think what it means is Bill Gates and Warren Buffett think there are too many people in the world for their needs, for their purposes. They don't need this many people in the world. I mean, I really think that's how these guys think. Because if you think of any kind of objective measure, you know, they'll say things like the carrying capacity of the planet. And these are meaningless metrics when you get right down to it, because you have to ask yourself, well, how is the economy organized? What kind of consumption patterns do people have? If everybody lives like the guys in the World Economic Forum, they're the ones who are always talking about this stuff. Sustainability, too many people, yada, yada, yada.
Yep.
They go to this meeting in private jets, okay?
I know.
This is how these people live. So this has nothing to do with whether a nice lady in Burkina Faso in Africa can have a fourth baby if she wants one. You know, I mean, that a lady in Cameroon, a lady in Ghana, if she wants a third or fourth or fifth child, she's not going to have anything like the kind of footprint that these guys are having.
No,
you
of
know?
Course not.
I mean, it's completely, really, when you think about it, it doesn't add up, you know? You can't come up with an objective standard that says too many people. Well, which ones are the excess?
Yep.
You know? That's what they've done, is they've given themselves mental permission to say, you're part of the excess, you are not excess. You know, like we heard during COVID, some jobs were essential and some jobs were not essential.
Yeah.
And we all know how stupid that was. I mean, you know, we all got a taste of how arbitrary these people were in their thought process, right?
Go ahead. You know, it's so weird, though. I would not want to stand behind these guys in judgment. I saw a stat that said that Warren Buffett spent $5.3 billion promoting abortion. That's enough to kill 10 million babies. You talk about a Holocaust. You know, we're seeing one today, and it's invisible, unfortunately. Dennis is in Cinnaminson, New Jersey. We only have a few minutes, so let me sneak him in quickly for you. Dennis, hi, you're on the air with Dr. Morris.
Hi, Dr. Morris. I just had a quick question, a comment, actually, on the vasectomy situation. So a lot of callers are coming in saying that if you have a vasectomy, you're going to go out and cheat. If you're married, you're going to go out and cheat on your wife. And I disagree with that. A lot of people can't afford it financially after they have two or three kids, and they don't want it anymore. Now, I know that's not morally right, but it's not that you're going to cheat.
Well, I'm not saying, you know, come on, Dennis, I wouldn't say everybody does. But I think it would be foolish to ignore the fact that some people will. You know what I mean? That's all I'm saying. You know, I mean, I would never claim that everybody does it, but it's for sure you've set up an incentive that's probably not going to, that's probably going to include people doing that, right?
Yeah, it certainly makes it a lot easier, doesn't it? And we know how Satan works.
That's my only point.
You know, there's one less concern, you know, about the, you know, going down that slippery path. And, you know, it really is an offense against your own human dignity and against the sacrament of marriage and your partner, too, you know, from a spiritual perspective. It's really wrong. Listen, do we have time for one more call, Maggie? No. All right. Brian in Green Bay, sorry about that and everyone else. Doctor, I have a moment left. So I want to give it to you then for your organization and for anything you'd like to leave us with.
Well, I appreciate that very much. We're the Ruth Institute, and the Ruth Institute is an international interfaith coalition to defend the family and build a civilization of love. And we would just love to have all you guys come over, sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to our YouTube channel, our podcast series, all of that kind of stuff, because we talk about these issues all day long, you know, whether it's population decline, whether it's contraception, whether it's the transgender movement. All of these things, we're talking about them all day long. And so we really, we have good resources for you to talk with your non-Catholic friends, because we are interfaith and we try to make our appeal as broadly as we possibly can. So we try to draw in the scientific evidence and stuff like that.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you. It's ruthinstitute.org, right?
Ruthinstitute.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks for making time. We'll catch up again soon. I always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you, Drew.
Thanks. That's Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris. Say a prayer for her. Check out her organization, ruthinstitute.org. When we come back, is America losing its work ethic? Well, there's new data out that says young men 18 to 24 still living at home, and they're not looking for work. In fact, we're at a 25-year low. So we'll take a look at that. Maybe you've experienced it. Is America losing its work ethic? We'll look at that more right after this. Hey, if you have real estate or land that you no longer need, well, consider the advantages of donating it to Relevant Radio. The process is easy, and the tax advantages can be huge. Learn more at relevantradio.com/property.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thanks for joining me. It's good to be here with you today. I'll change gears. I want to address one other issue, and that is whether or not America is losing its work ethic, right? Labor Day is Monday for most of us. It's a nice day to have a three-day weekend. Retail stores probably are going to be open, and a lot of people will be going to restaurants. And first responders, military, they'll be working, but for majority of businesses, they're shutting their doors, right? Labor Day is a day that has, goes all the way back to 1894 when President Grover Cleveland, in the 19th century, went ahead and, officially established this day of rest for all of us. And if you go back, you look at the 19th century, it was a time of a lot of labor unrest because of the Industrial Revolution. You know, we were coming out of that. Factories were being built all over the country. People were leaving the farms. They were attracted by the wages that, these factory owners promised them. It was a different lifestyle. And they didn't realize the working conditions were going to be horrible. You know, strikes happened regularly. There were outbreaks of violence. And the president signing off on the legislation was really an acknowledgement that people were producing goods in the country and, you know, that they were essential and their hard work was necessary and we should be acknowledged. So in the time since then, a lot's changed. Today, 63% of able-bodied people are in the workforce. Now, why is that? Why such a small number? More than a third of Americans who could be working aren't. You know, more than 41 million people right now are on government food benefits. This is the United States of America, right? It's more than 12% of the population. And it's up. It's an increase of 4.5 million people from the start of the COVID pandemic. So there's a friend of the show, a guy named Dr. Nicholas Eberstadt. He's a very famous demographer. He said this. He made this comment. He said 7 million men of prime working age are neither working, and here's the key, nor looking for work. 7 million prime working age men are neither working nor are they looking for work. So the question I want to look at today is, how do we lose that healthy desire for doing an honest day's work? We have universal basic income being proposed. We've got all sorts of other handouts, if you will. What has happened to the work ethic in this country? Don Fetter is a columnist for the Boston Herald, New England's second largest newspaper. He's been there for about 19 years. And since he left the Boston Herald in 2002. He served as a communication consultant and a writer and an organizer for various pro-life, pro-family organizations. And he joins me today. He's currently the coalition's director and director of communications for the Ruth Institute, which, again, you can find online at ruthinstitute.org. Great to have you back with us, Don. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew, and thank you for having me again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I know you also contribute to the Washington Times. Let people know about that. The work ethic, this is really, I find it troubling. Data says 36% of men 18 to 24 are still living at home. And the percentage of workers who are either employed or looking for work is at a 25-year low. So I know a lot of people probably have experienced this. The question is why? And what does this portend for the future?
There are a number of dimensions to this, Drew. One is the fact, of course, that we have one political party in this country that has consistently encouraged people not to work. They've said work is unfair, it's unjust, the government should just give you whatever you need. You don't need to work for it. Just look to the government for whatever you need. You know, food, housing, medical care, whatever it is. The government owes it to you. In other words, the taxpayers owe it to you, and a lot of people believe that. One of the things I find interesting, Drew, is that in 1940, when unemployment was 15%, we had greater labor force participation. Well, labor force participation rate was higher in 1940 with 15% unemployment than it is today.
Wow, that's fascinating. It really is. Let me open the phones, too. We'll take a few calls. The number here is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. And maybe you are seeing this. Maybe you got somebody at home that's not getting off the couch or won't get a job. Maybe you're a small business owner. And I'll share an experience I had with somebody who can't get employees to stay and work for them. My guest today, Don Fetter, we're taking a look at the work ethic of America. Why in such an affluent, robust nation do we have so many unemployed? And why are so many men not working? Mark is in Eureka, California. Mark, hi, you're on the air with Don Fetter. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, Mr. Fetter. I've had
How are
a
you,
personal
sir?
Theory. Hi. Good, thanks. I've had a personal theory for some time. I don't know if this applies to younger males per se, and I understand this is a generalization, and I do know I might rub people the wrong way, but I've had this idea that with feminism, mm-hmm. and it's been growing for some time, but men have, obviously, as people don't get married as often and they have less kids, the need for a man to go out and work has diminished as to the value it used to have. But also, as women are in the workforce, and I'm not saying women shouldn't work or anything, I'm just saying it introduces a competition. And I honestly think that men just don't want to compete against women for things. And that's a personal theory. I could be wrong. But, yeah, what are your thoughts about the idea of going up head-to-head against, you know, all this stuff?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting theory, Mark. I don't know. I have to look at it from my own perspective. I'm very competitive, just as a guy. I think a lot of men are wired that particular way. So in terms of competition, I don't know whether men feel, hey, I don't want to compete because she's a woman. I do think feminism has played a role, and I think that's a really interesting angle, one that I've not thought about. And Don, I know the Ruth Institute is very big on this issue as well. I'll pull you in so you can expand on that as well.
I think the caller has a point, Drew. There are a lot of men who are discouraged. There was a time when men were breadwinners. In fact, there was a concept called the family wage, which meant that if a man was married and had children, you assumed he was the breadwinner, and you paid him more than you would a single male. Of course, you couldn't do that today. It would be considered discriminatory. But, I think feminism has had an impact on this.
Mark, thank you for your call. No, I appreciate it. It's a great perspective. We'll take, is it Rainey in Phoenix, Arizona? Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. It's rain, like when it rains outside.
Rain. Good to have you with me. Thanks.
Hey, I just wanted to give kind of a different aspect for the question. I'm 27 years old myself. I'm a young man, blue-collar worker. My father is a farmer rancher here in Arizona, and I just think that a lot of younger men were not necessarily taught how to work, if that makes sense. So, like, for me, my father, I was with him as long as I can remember, learning how to farm, learning how to ranch, doing all these things, working with my hands. I think a lot of my generation and generations going forward are going to miss that aspect of, working with their father and kind of learning the ways, in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many men today who grow up without fathers.
Correct.
Right. Look, I'm 76, going on 77, and I've been working since I was 18, probably before I was 18, doing part-time work. But I had a father in the home who taught me the value of work. My grandfather, who was an immigrant and a tailor, used to say, "I don't care what a man does, if a man works, he can take pride in what he does." And unfortunately, a lot of young men, as the caller says, aren't raised with that ethic.
Yeah, that's so true. Rainey, I your dad retired. Do you still get a chance to work with him?
No, so my dad's actually, he's partially retired. I'm getting ready to kind of potentially step into some of his roles. He actually just recently became a deacon in the Catholic Church, so he's going to focus a little bit more on that. And we're looking forward to all the great stuff he's got to offer to my kids. Yeah. And my nieces and nephews and stuff like that. So,
I appreciate the call. Hey, good luck. Okay, sounds great. Jonathan is in Woodland, California. It's the Sacramento area. Let's bring him into the conversation. Jonathan, hi. You're on the air with Don Fetter.
Yes. What you've been talking about young men don't want to work. I think part of that is caused by the government is giving them freebies. They don't have to pay rent. And I think what the government needs to do is put it on their taxes, the ones that refuse to work.
I like that.
Well, you have a valid point. A lot of people can exist. In fact, there are families that have been existing for generations without work. You know, there was a time in this country when you worked or you starved. Today, you can live fairly well without working. Between food stamps, housing vouchers, Medicaid, and all of the rest of it, you can exist without working. You can exist indefinitely. And that's one reason that the labor force participation rate is so low.
Hey, Don, hold the thought. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we can talk a little bit more. I'll share a quick story before I go to break, though, about somebody I saw. Maybe some business owners can relate to this. When I was living in another state, I had an air conditioning unit that went out on me. And I had to have the unit serviced, and then ultimately I had to have it replaced. And I was out there with the guy who came out to do it, the HVAC guy, and he owned a business, small business in the area. And I'm sitting there talking to him as he's doing the job, because I just like to talk to people. I said to him, I said, "Hey, so, I said, hey, is this your business? Who works it?" Because he's all by himself. He says, "Drew, I can't keep anybody." I said, "I can't get any kids to work with me, anybody to do this." He says, "My own children want nothing to do with the business, and everybody who I hire, they end up ultimately leaving." And I see so many people no longer wanting to do what you may call a blue-collar job. I mean, that HVAC guy probably makes bank, and he would leave that business to whoever probably took it over. He'd love to see his legacy carry on. But it's an interesting question why people do not want to do a specific type of labor. There was a study that was out. They asked people, what do you want to do? You know, and the number one thing in life for them was to be famous, you know, to be an influencer, followed by wealthy. You know, the jobs came secondary to that. So we've got a different mindset with this next generation. The data saying, you know, we're at a 25-year low with men in the workforce. A lot of men still living at home. Well, that's what we're talking about if you just joined us. I'll get your take on it. What are you experiencing in the workplace, and what are you experiencing at home? Has America lost its work ethic? And if so, what's that mean for the future? All that and more when I return.
The Drew Mariani Show.
Hi, Drew. Thank you. Thank you for your show.
This is the Drew Mariani Show.
Marvelous show on the radio right now.
On Relevant Radio.
Hey, looking for a new job? How about one that offers opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester. An Illinois Life Insurance Society, not available in all states.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, thanks for joining me. Looking forward to talking with you. You can get in on the conversation right now at 888-914-9149. I came across an article by my guest, Don Fetter. He hails from the Ruth Institute and raises a great question. His headline is, America's Losing Its Work Ethic, The Liberating Nature of Labor. And it made me think, you know, what's going on? Why are so many men staying at home? Why are so many men not in the workforce? And what's happening to our country at large? So many people love the concept of universal basic income. They love UBI, right? We lived through a pandemic where a lot of money was handed out as well. Work has a moral dimension to it. And the way you view work reflects your view of life. And if life has no meaning, then you know, you're probably not going to work. And maybe it's reflective of the heart and the minds of people today. In Genesis, there's that famous quote, you know, by the sweat of your brow, you know, you'll eat your food, you know, after the fall. And Maggie, you were talking about a quote from St. Paul, I think, in Thessalonians, right?
Yeah, in Thessalonians, as we were talking, I was like, why does this ring a bell? In 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 7, I'll read a couple of these lines here. It says, "For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We were not idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we worked night and day, laboring and toiling, so that we would not be a burden to any of you. We did this not because we have the right to such We do not have the rights to such help, but in order to offer ourselves as a model for you to imitate. For even when we were with you, we gave you this rule: the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." And then he actually goes as far to say, "As we hear that some among you are idle and disruptive." Wow. "They are not busy, they are busy bodies. Such people we command and urge in the name of Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the food that they eat. And as for you, brothers and sisters, never tire of doing what's good."
Everybody wants something for free today, don't they? And Don, you pointed out in your piece, which I thought was well-researched, some phenomenal stats, that even the early colonists, you know, in this country, they embraced what was called the Protestant work ethic. Let's talk a little bit about the moral dimension, if we can, and even what the founders of our of this country of ours, how the Puritans were famous for their belief in the redemptive quality of labor, the dignity of work.
The Puritans and Pilgrims in New England, you know, they were all about what they called the redemptive quality of work. Jamestown Colony, they found. You know, but there were, John Smith, I think, put it very well. He invaded against the people who you know, they found what they thought was a paradise. You know, there was vegetation all over. They had an opportunity to trade with the Indians, and a lot of them didn't want to work. They spent their time looking for gold, because you know they heard that there was an abundance of gold there too, and you know, Smith was, he put an end to it. He said, "Look, if you're not willing to work, you're not going to eat." Which, of course, goes back to the admonitions in the Bible, including the verse in Thessalonians that you quoted. You know, the Bible is all about making people understand the importance of work, the necessity of work, their responsibility to work for themselves and their families. They have to set an example for their children. And as one of the callers pointed out, there are so many young people today who were being raised without a work ethic, because when they were growing up, there weren't responsible adults in the home who taught them the importance of work.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, you bring up some great points in your piece, too. And I want to grab a few more calls, but you talk about not just the moral dimension. I think that's really the underpinning of all this, the foundation. But under our current administration, they're committed to expanding the dole. They love to spend money, and you make the claim that the welfare state is metastasized. I thought it was such a great way of putting that, because my understanding is that food stamp enrollment right now is at a historic high. And again, as I said when I opened, this is the United States of America. 41 million plus currently, you know, needing the handout from the government. And look, I don't want to disparage anybody who needs it. I think that's what it's there for. But, you know, why are the numbers so high? And you could argue it's COVID, but I think that might be a little bit of an excuse right now. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah, you know, people in government are encouraged to continually expand food stamp enrollment. And as you said, there are 41 million Americans who are currently getting food stamps, which is 12.5% of a total population. Not only that, it's 4.5 million more been at the outset of the COVID epidemic. Yeah. Of course, it's, you know, the dole is power.
Yes, it is.
It's a free ride for some people, but it's power for other people.
Yeah.
If they can control benefits, they can control your life.
Yeah. The other thing here, too, and let's grab some calls. I have a couple of minutes, so this conversation deserves a lot more time. The exodus from work, so many guys staying home, people not in the workforce, it has its impact. Slower economic growth for the country. We have wider gaps in wealth, you know, in income. There's more dependence on the government welfare programs that we're talking about now. More pressure on families, loss of social mobility. I mean, the list goes on. Less involvement in society and a lot of deaths and despair. We're seeing all this manifested right now. So my question before we take calls is, how do we remedy this? How do we get this right? Because this is very consistent with a Marxist agenda.
Well, I think one of the things we have to do is limit the benefits. Take a cold, hard look at the benefits we're providing to people. Not on a needs basis, necessarily. As you said earlier, Drew, that, yeah, there are people who need these things. Really, there are people who are elderly who can't work. There are people who are ill. There are women, single women with children who need help.
Amen. And they should take it. They should use it.
Absolutely. Without any guilt at all. But there are so many people who don't need it. There are so many people who want a free ride. They don't see why they should exert themselves when people are willing to throw all of these things at them.
Yeah. All right, let's grab a call or two because we only have a few moments left. A lot of people want to talk to you. We'll go to Rhode Island next. Ernie's been waiting. Ernie, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew.
Hey, Ernie.
One of the things that I haven't heard addressed so far, and I agree with like 90% of what you guys are saying, especially in the moral aspect of work.
Yeah.
I'm 44 years old, so I'm not part of this Gen Z or anything, but I see a lot of people online who are from that generation who are not liberal, who are not on the government dole, who express this idea that even if they went to work and gave it everything they had, they still wouldn't make a living wage because, you know, in order to have a car and a mortgage, it's almost priced out of, you know, you'd have to be making over $100,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And what earlier generations had was they could go to work with a high school diploma and support a family of five with a mortgage and a car. And, you know, it's just not possible these days, especially in the blue states.
Yeah, it's such a great point.
I'll hang up and I'll let you guys respond to that. Yeah,
wonderful point. Ernie, thank you so much for joining us. Go ahead, Don. I'll let you respond. We got about a minute and a half.
Yeah, it is a good point, Ernie. It's a vicious circle. You know, government gives out all of these benefits. How are they going to pay for them? They print more money. That leads to inflation, and that's why everything is so expensive today. You know, government provides the benefits, but then government pays for the benefits by making things expensive. You know, my parents bought a house in 1955. They paid $11,000 for it. Obviously, money was worth more then than it is today, but still, the one reason housing is so expensive is because government has pushed up the price through regulations, by requiring banks to give mortgages to people who aren't good risks. You know, you could...
Hey, Don, let me hold it right there. I want to make sure people read your article. I think it's really well done. Very, very insightful. My apologies, everyone who I can't get to. The name is Feder. It's spelled F-E-D-E-R. You can check him out at the Ruth Institute. He wrote a wonderful piece raising the question, America is losing its worth. I do a search for it. We'll post it as well.